Well, tonight we continue what I would like to call a subordinate corollary to our 26-part series in defense of the resurrection, and that is a detailed analysis of a controversial artifact, ancient artifact, called the Shroud of Turin. In part one of examining the shroud and arguing for it being the burial cloth of Jesus Christ, the heavy probability that it is, we looked at forensic characteristics. I think we got to 20 or 22 of those characteristics. There's 40 total here and from the book, The Case for Christ's Resurrection, that I'm borrowing from. 40 forensic characteristics that denote that this linen is more likely than not the burial cloth of Yeshua HaMashiach. One scientist calculates that the burial cloth being that of the image of Jesus Christ is 1 to 83 million. Again, that's something he calculated. I don't even think you have to use that argument. Just look at the shroud itself, what it's on there, what it contains, and so forth. And I think, again, the evidence points to it being the very cloth our Lord was buried and rose in. And so in that vein, let us continue to look at the forensic items on the shroud that would lend us to believe that it is, more likely than not, the burial cloth of the Lord Jesus Christ. Again, we will probably do one or two more, teachings on this after tonight. I think it's very important that the Church Universal studies this very closely. And this is where the evangelical slash Protestant slash Eastern Orthodox Church have failed, and where the Roman Catholic Church has excelled. They have looked at the shroud, it's under their care, and they have presented more evidence for it being the burial cloth of Jesus than any other denominational group. Now, let us not fall into the genetic fallacy trap that many Protestants do with their biases when they come to the shroud. They immediately dismiss the shroud as being a genuine article because, after all, the Catholics own it, and so it's got to be automatically wrong. Well, that's a genetic fallacy, the fallacy that says that an origin of something or someone disproves or disqualifies that something or someone from saying something true or relevant. Okay? So we need to avoid that. We're looking at the shroud itself. We're not looking at a church ideology, whether from the Protestant sphere or the Catholic sphere here. We're looking at the shroud itself. And the beautiful thing about this is in 1978, when STIRP was convened, let me write that on the board here. STIRP. That's an acronym for the Shroud of Turin Project. Scientists from all over the world, particle physicists, botanists, nuclear physicists, ancient textile experts, I'm leaving out some other stuff, anatomists, so forth and so on. Once they got the permission of the Vatican, they did an extensive study of the shroud with electron microscopes, and they examined every inch of the shroud. One of the official expert photographer that was a member of STIRP was a man by the name of Barry Schwartz, who is Jewish. And he was interviewed on the EWTN, the Catholic channel. Barry Schwartz is an Orthodox Jew. And he believes that the shroud, after examining it with his scientific peers during STIRP, that the study, it's about a five-day study in 1978, he believes that the man on there is Jesus of Nazareth. And he said that when he came to that realization, it drew him more closer to the God of Judaism. He didn't come out and say he was a believer in Yeshua. But Barry Schwartz has it is the official website for the shroud, an excellent resource if you want to know more about the shroud. at www.shroud.com. How ironic it is that one of the premier spokesmen and defender of the Shroud is Jewish. In fact, when he was being interviewed on this EWTN, he said, God's always used Jews to be his spokesman, and he laughed. And he said, the New Testament and what we know about Jesus was proclaimed by Jews. So shouldn't be surprised that any... said that God would choose, you know, a Jew to air the evidence for the Shroud's authenticity. So Barry Shroud has done some excellent work on vindicating the Shroud as an ancient artifact of first century Israel. That's what you first have to establish before anything else if you're going to accept that the forensic characteristics of the Shroud point to Jesus of Nazareth at the moment of the resurrection event. Or as Dame Pitsick calls an event horizon. She says that, and she's an art expert and a particle physicist, she says that what we see on the Shroud of Turin, the man on the Shroud who was beaten, whipped, crucified, thrust through by a Roman lance into the heart, what we see on here and the image being emblazoned on there mysteriously is a horizon event. Meaning, an event that has never happened before. Anyway. All right, let's continue. I believe we covered about 20, I don't want to say 21 or 22. I forgot where we stopped. But we'll just give a quick review and move on to the 23rd forensic feature that's on the Shroud. As we have said before, many of the flower, there are flower images on the Shroud, actual flowers, and also pollen grains from flowers. Now, why are there flowers on the Shroud? Again, Barry Schwartz, the photographic scholar who has a background in Orthodox Judaism and does know of burial practices of first century Judaism, said that flowers were placed in Israel among the dead when they were being wrapped to fumigate and make the body scented. And so we would expect no different from Jesus. Now, they did this as a preliminary to the full embalming of the body on Sunday morning. They put these flowers in there that were indigenous to Jerusalem and the surrounding area outside Jerusalem. They took these flowers, put them in the Shroud as a preliminary embalming of the body to stave off odor and decay. And yet, we know that when we look at this body, it was in the tomb for about 36 hours. Anything beyond that, you would see decay on the body, decomposition. There is no decay. And I knew that, but I was surprised to hear Barry Schwartz in this interview say that the Messiah's body will not see corruption. So I don't know if Schwartz is a believer in Yeshua, but he knows about the prophecy in the Tehillim, the Psalms, about how the Messiah's body would not suffer any type of corruption by death. And on the Shroud, there is no corruption. The body is irradiated. And through that, it was emblazoned on the fabric. That's a scientific fact, folks. And what I'm sharing with you are scientific facts that these scientists at STIRP and down through the decades since 1978 have discovered about this one-of-a-kind artifact. So the flower images appear to be as they would have looked 30 to 36 hours after they were picked. The only place in the world where this collection of flowers could be found in a fresh state is in the immediate vicinity of Jerusalem. Their common blooming time is March and April. Swiss botanist Dr. Fry took tape samples from the Shroud, examined the pollen and the grain underneath microscopes and so forth, and made and ascertained this was the case. Now, we also said that some of the icons, the pictures of Jesus, starting early on in the first few centuries of the church, parallel or imitate the face on the Shroud. And wouldn't you know that some of these flower images on the shroud, with their positions on the shroud, being rather accurate, are centuries following the first century, are depicted on icons such as the Christ Pantocrator of St. Catherine's Monastery in Sinai, the 6th century icon or picture of Jesus. They are also found on Byzantine coins such as the gold Salutis of 692 AD. So apparently, the shroud was around before the medieval period, because one of the criticisms of the shroud is that it was a painting from the medieval period and therefore a forgery. Well, how do you explain the fact that the face of the shroud is replicated in the iconography of early Christianity and is even seen on the minting of coins from the Byzantine Empire? Let me give you one example of a flower that is so specific as to time and place where the shroud was. I hold up in my hand a picture of the Israeli flower called Capparis aegyptia. In English, that's Egyptian caper. It is also called a clock flower. The reason why is because the bud begins opening in the morning and is fully open just before sundown. A botanist can tell the time of day by the degrees of opening of the flower and its anthers. These little stems are the anthers that you see there. When the flower is picked, the opening immediately stops and remains at that state. It's frozen in time, so to speak. So if you pick this flower at 12 o'clock noon, they'll be able to tell what degree of closing this flower is at or opening the exact time when it was picked. The clearly identifiable images of the clock flower on the shroud indicate that those flowers were picked between what time? You people in here who know the word, 3 to 4 o'clock. Corresponding to the time the body of Jesus was taken down from the cross. That's clear forensic evidence. You can't deny that. Out of a bias towards Catholic custodial care of the shroud or any other bias, whether it be the atheist who will not accept supernatural realities. But this clock flower proves, and it is only indigenous to Israel and the Sinai region, that it was picked around 3 or 4 o'clock and was placed upon the shroud as part of the preliminary embalming process. Well, the fact that this flower on the shroud indicates it was picked around 3 or 4 o'clock entirely agrees with the scriptural accounts of the timing of the crucifixion, entombment, and resurrection. There are two other flowers we could cite here. One called, it's a thistle called Gundelia terniforti and the Sigophyllum dumosum. Both grow in the Sinai desert. And this, both flowers would localize the origin of the shroud to the immediate vicinity of Jerusalem, since that is the only area where the growth boundaries overlap. So here we have botanical proof, if you will, that this linen cloth was in Jerusalem in first century Israel, and that these flowers that were placed within the shroud were part of the embalming process. Now let's look at the posture of the body. Number 25, another forensic feature favoring this being the crucified man from Nazareth. Look at the legs. Primarily the backside of the image. You have your handout I gave you, a negative picture of the shroud. Look at how the legs and the feet are configured. They're like this. I'll get over here so you can see. They're like this, if you look carefully. See? And there is a profusion of blood on one leg. It is all over the sole of the feet. On the other, it's a rivulets, two major rivulets of blood. We see here the legs are arched, the body of this man, the legs are arched with one foot slightly higher than the other. This is consistent with the posture and configuration of the feet and leg positions associated with the mode of crucifixion, which characteristically has one foot placed on the other to facilitate nailing to the cross. And I believe on one knee, trying to remember which one, on one knee, there is evidence of a wound or a swelling consistent with a fall while carrying the cross. That's number 26, forensic feature of the Shroud of Turin. Now, I wasn't able to get a photocopy of the face of the shroud in enough time, but this brings us to the 27th forensic feature. The nose cartilage is dislocated on the face on the left-hand side. There is pronounced swelling of one of the cheeks immediately below the eye, possibly the result of being struck in the face or a fall. Now, before someone says, well, wait a minute, you're saying nose cartilage is dislocated. Cartilage is not a bone, so you can't say that. That contradicts what John says in the 19th chapter. Not a bone of his is broken. In fact, all the scientists who've looked at the shroud said there are no broken bones. Again, it agrees with Scripture. Not a bone of his shall be broken, fulfilling the type of the Passover lamb in sacrifice. Exodus 12. But the face is, and again, I don't have a close-up of the face, but when you look at it on the on one of the sides of the cheek is noticeably swollen. And we know that Jesus was punched and slapped and hit in the face, starting with his trial before Caiaphas in the early hours of the morning when he was brought to his palace for Jesus' religious trial. The 28th feature on this on the shroud itself is the image resembles an autoradiograph. In other words, what I'm saying is it's a type of X-ray. It contains identifiable images of bones, teeth, eye orbits, and sinus cavities. Again, that disallows it from being a painting. You cannot create an autoradiograph or a quasi X-ray by painting something. 29th feature. There are no dyes, pigments, or stains on the shroud that correlate with the image. None is found on there. Now, some skeptics of the shroud believe that because the blood is so red on the shroud, this would mean that it has to be some type of paint. But as we said before, hematologists who have studied the shroud said that when a body is violently treated and beaten and so forth, blood releases, I'm trying to remember the name of that. Let me look it up. It releases a certain chemical which enhances the color of the blood. Let me find that here. I think it's bilirubin, but I want to make sure. I don't even know if... I'm not finding it here. But we mentioned that in part one of the study. And again, that would account for the vivid redness of the blood that is on the shroud. And hematologists have confirmed this very fact, that this person was suffered a violent beating, a very violent beating, by the way, not the cosmetic depictions you see in movies on the life of Jesus. A 30th forensic feature of the shroud is that, now this is very interesting, image information resides only on the top fibrils that make up shroud threads. The blood was on the shroud before the image was formed. The blood was on the shroud before the image was formed. The contrast of the image information decreases as you descend down around the sides of the fibrils, terminating at the exact side, 9 degrees off top center, as it were, emblazoned on the cloth from an infinite number of points, sources residing within on the body it covered. The image is made up of tiny detailed pixels, something you cannot get with a painting. Number 31, 31st forensic feature of the shroud is the visible image information resides only within the first few microns of the surface of each fibril. A micron is 1/1000th of a meter. So the image itself is on the shroud about several microns on top of it. The image does not go through to the back. The image on the front only goes for a few microns into the fibrils of the shroud, and ditto for the back image. But the blood goes all the way through. And it was on there first before the image was formed. The 32nd forensic feature of the shroud is the image is only on the shroud surface that faced toward the body. There is no image information on the reverse of the cloth. In other words, the front of the cloth did not permeate into the backside and vice versa. Therefore, this leads us to the 33rd feature. The blood has soaked through to the backside of the shroud. And it is AB negative blood, which was common for Middle Eastern people. Very rare and uncommon for Europeans to have AB negative blood, but very common among Semitic people living in the Middle East. You can't make this stuff up. I mean, science has confirmed all of this. A 34th forensic feature is the image appears to be the result of some form of coherent radiant energy which emanated from the body. We've mentioned that before. Some type of unearthly radiant energy emitting a brilliant light of some kind somehow did not burn it on there, but emblazoned this image on the shroud. There are no burned carbon deposits on the shroud. That would result from a burning effect from fire or heat. It's not on there. And yet, scientists in their study at STIRP determined what it was not, what the image of the shroud is not. However, they could not determine, and to this day, still don't know how it got on there specifically. But it was some type of radiant energy emanating from the body itself. One naval scientist bridges the gap between science and faith and says it was the power of the resurrection, the glory of God emanating from the Son of God at the moment of the resurrection event that emblazoned the crucified form of Messiah on the shroud. And I would tend to agree with him. Again, that is beyond the realm of empirical science, proven by the fact that they don't know how the image got on there. They do know with certainty how it did not get on there. I.e. a painting of some kind or rubbing the garment on somebody with dye or charcoal or whatever. A 35th feature of the shroud, a forensic feature, is there is remarkable correlation between the shroud's facial image and the face of Jesus depicted on icons and coins from the 6th century on. The presence and anatomists and iconographic experts have looked at these pictures of Jesus, compared them to the shroud, and they came up with hundreds of points of congruence between the two images. That would indicate a number of the artists had to have looked directly at the shroud face as the model for their icons. And this brings us to this 36th forensic feature. There are very early representations of Jesus in the catacombs of Domitilla and others in Rome from the end of the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries that are totally shroud-like. And then let's talk about, as a 37th forensic feature, the nail wounds that are on the shroud. Look at your handout. Where are the nail wounds? They're not in the center of the palm of the hand, like modern art and movies of Jesus have wrongly depicted. The nail wounds are in the wrists, not in the hands. And by the way, the Jews and the Romans considered part of the wrist, right where the medial nerve begins, as part of the hand, part of the palm. The nail wounds are in the wrists, not in the hands, which is a departure from Christian tradition and art. Only in the wrists would a driven nail support the weight of a human body without breaking any bones, especially during the convulsions associated with a crucifixion of this type. Oftentimes, the Romans would take the nail and nail it in an angle through the space between the medial nerve, and that would hold the body up, especially when it was going through convulsions. It would not hold up if the nail was in the palm of the hand. It would rip off the cross. I don't have his name here, but he wrote a book, can't remember his name, begins with a Z. He did extensive studies with cadavers and so forth and live people. He didn't nail live people's hands up, but he designed special gloves, suspended them on a cross-like object, and discovered that the best way you could secure and affix a person to a cross was through the nails going through the wrist of the hands. 38, and this is very important. This is what Sturt first discovered in their 1978 examination of the shroud at the chapel of St. John the Baptist in Turin, Italy. They discovered, 38 forensic feature, they unanimously discovered, without any dissent from the inside, the scientists discovered that there is no indication anywhere on the shroud or factor of directionality in the image. Well, what's that? Directionality is the brush strokes of a painting. This way, that way, up, down. No brush strokes of directionality on the shroud, anywhere on it. So it can't be a painting. The image is a totally random deposit of information, which is powerful evidence, contrary to it being the result of human invention. It is not the product of a human eye-hand coordination. And if it was a painting, it would not be anatomically correct. Even the most accurate paintings and done will always have an element of inaccuracy in it, no matter how good it looks, when dealing with the anatomical structure of human bodies. Not so with the shroud. It is anatomically correct in every way. A 39th feature, forensic feature on the shroud, is the image pixel boundaries of the shroud image terminate abruptly, which is unique among photographs and paintings. This would seem to indicate that the image producing mechanism was some kind of discrete, vertically directed, radiation-like agent of pinpoint accuracy. And the rest is a mystery of how it got on there. Finally, we have the 40th forensic feature, and there are much more. I'm selecting this from the excellent book called The Case for Christ's Resurrection. There are much more forensic features to the shroud. You could write a whole book on it. That was something I would toy with if I had the time. And when we talk about forensics, you know what that means, right? You're dealing with evidence that would be legally admissible in a court of law. And these would be. You saw in the shroud documentary, The Lawyer. Remember, The Lawyer was arguing for the authenticity from evidence showing that the shroud is the burial cloth of Jesus the Messiah. And by the way, before I give you the 40th, one criticism that I've come up with is people will say, well, how come this isn't in the Bible? How come we don't read about Jesus' Jewish followers discovering, you know, they did discover the burial cloth and the headpiece. We have that in the Gospels. But why don't we have any record of them taking those things out of the tomb? Well, keep in mind that in Jewish culture, burial clothes and blood on burial clothes were considered both sacred and unclean. Furthermore, they're not going to go around parading this. Hey, we have evidence of the resurrection. Look at the image of the risen Messiah, Jesus, on, because the enemies of Jesus were desperate to destroy any type of evidence that pointed to Jesus' resurrection, thus proving his messiahship. Case in point, Lazarus, John 11. They were, the Sanhedrin attempted to try to have Lazarus killed in order to destroy evidence that Jesus had power to raise people from the dead. And the disciples were smart. They weren't going to just marshal this thing around because no doubt it would have been seized and taken and destroyed. And that's why I believe it was quickly ferreted out of Jerusalem to Turkey. And Barry Schwartz makes a good arguments for that, why you don't find it in the Jewish New Testament, written by Jewish eyewitnesses of Jesus, why you don't find them taking the shroud and keeping it. Because it would have alerted the enemies of the early church who had it where it was so they could destroy it. And thus preserve the lie that Jesus did not rise from the dead. A 40th and final forensic feature here in our study is that while the shroud was carbon dated to the years 1260 to 1390 and 1988, the result is totally wrong for the shroud. Ray Roberts, one of the scientists who is expert in the ancient textiles, discovered that on the shroud, and you have it here, go to right down here, they took the piece from right down there. Well, through a microscopic analysis and spectrographic analysis, it was discovered beyond any doubt that that small portion was part of the patchwork that was done on the shroud after the fire of 1532. And then that patched area was dyed to match the color of the original shroud. They've proven that. So that has already been determined that the patch that was taken and carbon dated was from the 16th century, which that's when they repaired the shroud after the fire in 1532. Then came the retesting, which was brought to my attention by Diana in here, and I thank her for doing that. I had seen this story back when they originally did it, and I got to check that out. But I was in the midst of writing one of my books, and I never went back to it. But it was brought to my attention, and we'll mention it now. There was a retesting of, and they made sure that this time it was an original part of the cloth, not a patchwork, dyed in color to look like the rest of it. They took an original piece of the cloth, retested it, and lo and behold, here's the results. A test conducted on the shroud in March of 2013, carbon-14 test, the second one, was done by researchers at Italy's University of Padua. The tests indicate that the linen sheet believed by some to be Christ's burial cloth dates back to Jesus' lifetime. The 14-foot long cloth bearing the image of a man with crucified wounds, similar to those suffered by Christ, was analyzed by university scientists using infrared light. The research linking the shroud to between 280 BC and AD 220 was published in a book by Giulio Fanti, a professor at Padua University, and journalist Saverio Gita. And the book is called The Mystery of the Shroud. Has not been translated yet in English. Fanti told the London Daily Telegraph that the results were based on 15 years of research on fibers taken from the cloth, which were subjected to radiation intensity tests. Fanti told the paper he rejects the conclusion of carbon dating tests conducted in 1988 that bolstered the theory the shroud was made in the 13th or 14th century in a medieval forgery. Those results, Fanti said, were, quote, false, unquote, because of laboratory contamination. And they prove that through microscopic analysis. So now we have The second carbon 14 dating test conducted in March of 2013 on an original part of the cloth of the shroud shows us what we would expect, and that is that the shroud dates anywhere roughly from 200 BC to 200 AD, well within the time frame Jesus lived in. Not only that, other data from several sources and forensic features we've already looked at would indicate that the shroud actually dates from the spring of 30 AD in the immediate vicinity of Jerusalem. Now, I want to talk about the new, relatively new scientific findings on the shroud that deal with its three-dimensional image quality. Let's talk about that for a second. Scientists did discover in their analysis of the shroud that it has a unique three-dimensional holographic front and back image. Dr. Petrus Soons revealed in his findings details never before seen on the Shroud of Turin, or on, for that matter, a previous two-dimensional shroud photographs. The holograms also confirm earlier shroud findings and speculations. Dr. Soon's new findings include the following, and I believe there's nine features he noticed on here. So let's go through those. Number one, the position of the feet and the legs were never clearly visible in the photographs. Again, look at your photo here, negative photo of the shroud. The holograms reveal that both legs were arched and one foot was bent diagonally and the toes pointing toward the side, as they would appear if fixed against the vertical beam of the cross. The hologram reveals that one foot was positioned over the other foot, bending the leg at the knee. This was not clearly visible in any photographs taken prior to the holograms. On the holograms, the toes of both feet are visible. These were not fully visible in the photographs. Number two, on previous shroud photographs, a blood spot appears to be floating above the area of the head. The holograms clarify that this blood spot is actually on top of the head and probably due to a wound caused by a helmet of thorns, not a circle of thorns, but a helmet of thorns. This indicates that the crown of thorns was more cap-like than circular. And that agrees with the gospel depictions of the Passion. They all say a crown of thorns was placed on Jesus' head, not a circlet, but a crown of thorns. And that's seen in the image on the shroud. Look at it. Look at the brow of the head and the crown of the head. It is punctured through and through. Something that would indicate some type of abrasions placed on, not only around the head, but on top of the head, which would agree with the crown of thorns. Third, in the holographic images, the marks caused by the dumbbell-shaped weights on the end of a Roman flagrum, a Roman cat o' nine tails or a whip, follow the curves on the sides of the upper and lower legs as well as the shoulders. These curvatures could never have been faked in a painting. In other words, you see the curvatures that would denote a three-dimensional image of a body. You see these in the wounds that Jesus endured from the Roman flagrum. And the Roman flagrum, again, if you look on the body there, they had pieces of metal. Pieces of metal, and then the leather thong right there. And all these were joined together, and then you had the handle of the flagrum right there. And that matches the imprint, the lacerative imprints that you find on this body. You find two little dumbbell shapes, and in between would be the leather thong that made its acute impression upon the body. Again, that's historically accurate with first century Roman flagellation. How would a medieval artist know about this when there wasn't even such a thing as archaeology? All right, moving on. Fourth, Dr. Soon says, the holographic images exhibit two small solid objects on the eyelids. They've actually had pneumatists look at this, people who specialize in coins, ancient coins. And they discovered that these objects are believed by some shroud researchers to be the small coin called the Roman lepton, minted by Pontius Pilate between 29 to 33 AD. There's a image of a palm, I'm trying to remember if it was a palm tree or a staff on the shroud that's like that. And it was distinct only during the time of Pontius Pilate's prefectship in Judea. And they have discovered these coins were on the eyelids of Jesus. And yes, ancient historians of the Middle East said that placing coins over the eyes was a burial practice of first century Jews. Fifth, the holographic images clearly show the details of the sides of the face, which were not visible in conventional photographs. Sixth, the holograms validate other major findings, including the swelling under the right eye and the localization of the blood spots throughout the body. Seventh, on the back of the head in previous two-dimensional photographs, researchers observed what appeared to be a ponytail. The holographic images appear to confirm this speculation. Eighth, in the past, the beard was believed to be bifurcated or divided at the bottom. It is thought by some shroud researchers that the hologram indicates this is not the case, as an intact beard is visible in the holographic image. Discovery Channel did a whole documentary on the holographic nature of the shroud, and they actually show you the body in a three-dimensional animation, and then they show you the face of what it probably looked like. So you might want to check that out on YouTube. It's made by Discovery Channel. It's one thing for me to sit here and verbally describe this to you, but you need to go on YouTube, go to the Discovery. It's a Discovery documentary on the holographic image on the shroud, which normal two-dimensional images and paintings and drawings simply don't have. We also note on the beard, and this gets down to anatomical accuracy of a post-mortem crucified body, we also have what is called the what is seen on the image of the body, the discoloring and darkening of the mustache and beard on one side, which may be due to fluid that came out of the mouth and nose from the lungs. Pulmonologists would call this lung edema, the swelling of the lungs, which after death rupture and are exuded by the mouth and nostrils. This probably happened when the body was taken down from the cross and laid in a horizontal position. Also visible is the direction of the fluid flow from right above to left below. A portion of the right side of the mustache and the central portion of the beard did not receive this edema lung fluid and consequently does not show this discoloring and darkening. Ninth, a ninth feature of the holographic image and nature of the shroud that Dr. Soons discovered was this. Under the beard on the neck area, and this is really good, under the beard on the neck area of the frontal shroud image, the holographic images reveal the presence of a solid, flat object measuring exactly 4.5 by 2.5 inches. And on it, in the opinion of Dr. Soons, the object appears to have a 3-2-inch Hebrew or Aramaic letters on its surface. And some believe it says in Hebrew, Avi, my father, on the front. Very, very interesting. So those are the nine holographic features that indicate that the shroud is not a painting, but an actual encapsulation of a literal human body crucified and then laid to rest in a post-mortem state. Again, go to the Discovery documentary on YouTube, and they go into the whole holographic nature of the image on the shroud. Now, let's move on. I want to talk about why the Shroud of Turin is not a painting. There is no room for it being a painting whatsoever. And one of the premier scholars that does an excellent job on this is a Hungarian scholar by the name of Dame Isabel Pitzik. She is an art technique expert and a particle physicist. We saw her on the documentary reviewed here 4 or 5 weeks ago. I don't know if you remember her. She has some very interesting proofs and compelling proofs that preclude the shroud from being a painting. Serious researchers and skeptics alike have long sought to explain just how the image of a crucified man got on the Shroud of Turin. On the shroud is a most accurate and appropriate term, since nowhere does the image penetrate the fabric. Instead, it seems to rest on the topmost fibrils that make up the fibers of the fabric. As we said earlier, a few microns on the fabric. On the surface of the fabric. This is an important part of the mystery, since no known technology exists that is capable of replicating that effect. But one of the most persistent claims of the skeptics is that the image on the shroud is merely a painting ad nauseum. There was one particularly puzzling and I think dishonest attempt to further the notion that the image is a painting. This came with a television documentary produced in 2005. This documentary suggested that not only is the Shroud of Turin a painting, but it was actually painted by Leonardo da Vinci. The problem with that is that da Vinci would not be born for 100 years after the Shroud's first known public exposition in Lire, France. Particle physicist and art technique expert Dame Pitzik is a monumental artist with hundreds of paintings adorning churches, cathedrals, and other buildings all over the world. She is also a particle physicist and thinks that this idea is absolutely absurd. She commented on the issue. She says, there are many lesser arguments about the veracity of the Shroud of Turin, but referring specifically to the notion that Leonardo da Vinci painted the shroud, it should be obvious that he could not have done so. First, he was born 100 years after the first exhibition of the shroud, and his personal painting techniques are well known, and they do not fit any technique that we see on the shroud. She specifies, Da Vinci was an extremely slow painter, unable to master the techniques of fresco painting. That was the tragedy of the Last Supper, which started to peel during his lifetime. And recently, they have had a whale of a time trying to preserve that painting, because the content of the paint was also, after a while, loses its adhesiveness and begins to fall away. The mural, Da Vinci's mural called the Battle of Angion, started to run and was destroyed while he was still working on it. Unfortunately, most of the great master's works are in a varying state of preservation because of his slow and very layered technique, which he employed without exception. So he wouldn't just paint once, he would paint with many layers on the canvas of his work. That's problematic because the shroud has been examined centimeter by centimeter under the close scrutiny of microscopes, and there's absolutely no paint layers found on the Shroud of Turin. Thus, there is absolutely no chance that Leonardo da Vinci would have or could have painted it, even if it was a painting. Also, we have the detailed notebooks kept by Leonardo da Vinci. The great artist recorded even such minute details as a shoelace he bought for one of his students. In all of his notebooks, there is not one drawing, not even a sentence that would hint at any work on a shroud-like project. Yet, in an attempt to give the theory a veneer of modern science, the producers of this documentary in 2005 suggested that the art of photography must have been actually invented 600 years before it was recognized technology for the very purpose of creating the image on the shroud. They have no proof. There is absolutely no proof in the world that photography was invented 600 years ago. In fact, it was later admitted, according to some who were involved in this 2005 production of the television documentary, the experiments were all total failures, which proved, of course, the exact opposite. Dame Pitchett goes on to say, she says, the Leonardo da Vinci theory presents yet another dilemma for those who cling to it. Either the entire history of the Mandalorian, the shroud, which predates da Vinci by hundreds of years, must be discarded or otherwise explained, or one must suppose that there were two shrouds, the one that touched King Akbar in Turkey in the late first century, and brought by force of arms to Constantinople, and another shroud painted by da Vinci. Perhaps the most famous and adversarial critic of the authenticity of the shroud is the late Dr. Walter McCrone. Remember, he was on the documentary We View. Dr. McCrone did more to further this idea that the shroud is a painting and no more. He claimed, as an absolute fact, that the shroud was a painting. He said that he found on the shroud, through the use of microscopy, pigments and a paint medium that artists used in the Middle Ages. Now, let it be said that Dr. McCrone is not a layman. He does have excellent credentials as a scientist, particularly as a polarized light microscopist. He graduated from Cornell University with a PhD in chemical microscopy, and as the director of McCrone Associates, devoted his life to this direct method of scientific investigation. So you would think he knows what he's talking about. He uncovered a number of high-profile artistic forgeries in his long career. He wrote a book about his shroud research called Judgment Day for the Shroud, which is available on Amazon. But there are many others equally well-known and respected who disagree with McCrone's views. Prior to his death, Dr. McCrone was absolutely convinced that he was right, and the rest of the scientists who disagreed with him were wrong. He even predicted that some future scientists around the year 2279 would completely vindicate his findings. He believed that the 1988 carbon dating results had already vindicated his unyielding assertion that the shroud image was hand-painted by an artist in 1355. Now, he based this on what is called the D'Arches Memorandum. This is important to remember, or letter. D'Arches Memorandum. This was written by Bishop D'Arches in, I believe, the 16th century when the shroud was going on display. This bishop wrote a lengthy letter to the Pope saying that this is a forgery, it is a fraud, it should not be publicly exhibited as a genuine burial cloth of Jesus Christ. Why is it then that Father Rinaldi, with whom McCrone conducted a lengthy and ongoing correspondence relative to the shroud, once warned him that he was viewed as the adversary? Could it be because Dr. McCrone assumed an adversarial position? Yes, he did. One with great bias, I might have to add. Because Dr. McCrone is the only one of note that is going against the overwhelming majority of the scientific community who says that the shroud is definitely not a painting. Is there an agenda driving McCrone? May I say that McCrone is an agnostic, a self-admitted agnostic, I believe. So that will color his bias, I should think. Especially in light of the fact that there are scientists to examine the shroud who are neither Christian theists, deists, They were either atheists or agnostics, and they had to come to the objective conclusion the shroud was not a painting, and secondly, we don't know how it got on there. With regard to the bloodstains on the shroud, Macrone arrogantly dismissed the work of doctors Heller and Adler, both highly regarded scientists, by saying simply, "There is no blood on the shroud." Macrone then added, "Obviously, I amuse myself by thinking of Heller and Adler as stirp shroudies who found blood everywhere on the shroud." Well, neither Doctors Heller or Adler were members of the Strupp team. Actually, I misspelled that. I'm glad I caught that. It's Strupp. S-T-R-U-P. Sorry about that. S-T-R-U-P. So I correct myself. Shroud of Turin Project. These two doctors were not a member of the Strupp team. And also you had a hematologist part of this research project in 78 who verified, empirically verified beyond any reasonable doubt, that there was blood all on the shroud, on the body mainly. For his conclusions, Dr. Macrone relied almost exclusively on observations with a polarized light microscope, although he welcomed corroborations from microscopists using the more modern electron microscope. Former student Ray Rogers, a student of Dr. Macrone's, Ray Rogers concluded the image does not reside in an applied pigment. In other words, it's not a painting. There's no indication of that. The reflectance, fluorescence, and chemical characteristics of the shroud image indicate that the image recording mechanism involves some cellulose oxidation dehydration process. Dr. Macrone responded by caustically saying, "Well, I should ask Ray to return his certificate for successful completion of my course in polarized microscopy, which he took in 1959. So that's his response. Well then, how did Dr. Macrone, how did the cynical Dr. Macrone explain the negative aspect of the image and the fact of the three-dimensional quality, which no painting on record has? In yet another reply to a letter from Father Peter Rinaldi, who very pointedly asked the same question, Dr. Macrone wrote, "Well, I feel the negative character of the image is a coincidence, resulting from the artist's conception of his commission." How? No artist can produce, first of all, a three-dimensional quality to a painting. Second of all, the negative image reveals more than the shroud when it is seen by the naked eye. He passes it off as coincidence. He also said, "I feel it is also a coincidence that the negative image yields a three-dimensional figure." Never mind that that's impossible from the outset. He says, Macrone says, "This is a natural consequence of the artist's effort to produce a body image based on contact points." So, in other words, according to Dr. Macrone, the shroud image is a painting, period. And the scientific anomalies so far discovered are merely coincidences. Unfortunately, that notion, no matter how elegantly phrased, simply does not hold up to the forensic qualities or characteristics that have been discovered on the Shroud of Turin. Father Rinaldi repeatedly asked Dr. Macrone to discuss his findings with a qualified art expert, someone like Dame Pitzik. But Macrone wasn't interested. He said, "Well, my problem with a serious dialogue with qualified art experts," he wrote, "is finding one that I regard as an expert." Translation, finding an art expert who would agree with my conclusions. But the shroud is not a question for art experts, because art experts have already looked at it and already have eliminated the very real or remote possibility that the Shroud of Turin is a painting created by the hand of human contrivance. It is not a painting. But as an art expert, Dame Pitsick says she can assure everyone that the Turin Shroud is not a painting or an artifact made by man. Not only her, but other experts who have looked at the shroud. And then she gives a very technical argument against Dr. McCrone based upon outdated art techniques. Bear with me. Dr. McCrone's analysis, she says, refers to synovia or synocra, particles of Venetian red paint, a common medieval paint component that he says he found on the fabric. The claim was also made by Dr. McCrone that the shroud was painted with greatly diluted glue tempera. Glue erratically reacts to atmospheric changes. Therefore, it is used only with chemical stabilizers. If none can be found on the shroud's sticky tapes, then it is not a glue paint medium. It is, in its most diluted form, the medium does not permanently hold the paint particles. Also, this medium remains absolutely water-soluble. In the case of a highly diluted medium, one does not have to dislodge paint particles. They are loosely attached because of the unpleasant qualities of this medium. That is why this technique was seldom used for fine art. Dr. McCrone takes his knowledge of medieval paint techniques, Pitsick claims, from old books and art authors such as Cennino, Cennini, and Eastlake. She goes on to say the words, the technical art words or methods, synopsy or synocra, used by McCrone are not used today. And Venetian red is an arbitrary term used for the unknown synocra. The professional arts strongly state the shroud is not a painting or man-made artifact. The shroud is much more than any one of us could even start to understand. Well, such a technical argument and a very sophisticated argument, you would think that would put this whole the shroud as a painting theory to rest. Ah, not so. Dr. McCrone's influence reaches out from beyond the grave. In September of 2006, a major network took their cameras into the McCrone group, and the subjects of the Shroud of Turin, along with the Vinland map, were both raised as major hoaxes, uncovered by McCrone's particular brand of microscopy. The Vinland map is claimed to be a map that was painted or drawn by Norsemen showing their trek to America. It is still under dispute whether it's genuine or a forgery. A similar thing would be the James Ossuary in Jerusalem. It's still not determined whether it's a fraud or not. So the McCrone laboratories, pioneered and started by Dr. McCrone, are devoted to proving something authentic or something that is a hoax or a fabrication. Dr. McCrone's legend and his propensity to perpetuate that legend that the shroud is a painting as indisputable fact live on. Here's where he is caught in his dishonesty, whether intentional or not. And that is the representative from the McCrone group to whom the reporter spoke in this September 2006 piece began by saying that they had examined 88,000 particles and fibers from the shroud and from that determined unequivocally that the image was a painting. The interviewer seemed satisfied with that and apparently never thought to ask if 88,000 particles and fibers wouldn't have used up the entire fabric. According to Tom D. Mahuhala, president of STIRP at the time, who pointed out that the number was off by a factor of nearly 50. Dr. Free, in collecting his samples, his pollen and grain samples from the shroud, was hoping to find dust and pollens that might have been ingrained deeply in the fibers. He pressed firmly with his thumb and forefinger and as a result picked up an average of 100 fibrils and particles on each of his tapes. Stirp, on the other hand, was looking for anomalies in the fibrils themselves. So they put much less pressure when applying the tape. They averaged only 50 particles and fibrils per tape. According to Dr. Alan Wanger, who is the custodian of Dr. Fry's samples, are a total of 27 tape samples in the Fry collection, which, as far as can be determined, McCrone never had access to. And yet he's giving this gratuitous figure of 88,000 fibrils or fragments from the shroud. And there are a total of 38 tape samples in this Sturp collection, 37 of which are from the shroud and one from the Holland backing cloth. These were the samples loaned to Dr. McCrone by Ray Rogers. All of these sticky tape samples still exist. So even if the Frey collection is included, and assuming Dr. McCrone examined every particle and fibril in the Sturp collection, that amounts to only a grand total of 1,850 possible particles and fibrils available to McCrone. That is a long way from 88,000. The truth is that Dr. McCrone's polarized light microscope saw far less of the shroud than his company now represents. And at no time did Dr. McCrone or anyone else ever make a microscopic examination of the entire image. Television program moderators are asking the public, physicists, chemists, and medical experts, the high school teachers, children, even professed, committed Bible believers, is the shroud a painting? And of course, the answer is always wrong. First, a painting is always the result of an educated, conscious, and intelligent activity. It is never a strange single item like you have with the Shroud of Turin. It's truly sui generis, one of a kind. The Shroud of Turin does not fit. It does not fit into the cultural era of the times it was allegedly made, if you assume it's a medieval forgery or a painting. The shroud thoroughly and solely depends on the paint mediums, binders, and liquid forms, mediums that tie the paint particles to each other and to the paint background. If it were a painting, this then would create a continuous film that alone carries the image consciously willed by the painter to appear on the surface. If it was a painting, it would have this continuous film on the image. By natural law, it can only be visible, and it can only be a visible and continuous image while the medium remains intact. Once it starts to disintegrate, chunks of the image or the painting will be missing. The image on the Shroud of Turin is an intact, continuous image without any continuous paint medium fill. This is the strongest and most definite proof that the shroud is not a painting. This very fact alone is enough to kill the painting accusation. If an image on a painting could exist without a continuous medium paint film, it would be a greater miracle than the shroud itself. It would go against then all the laws of nature. If the mandolin and the Shroud of Turin are one and the same cloth, it has survived flood, fire, several wars, and 2,000 years of being folded, unfolded, damaged, and repaired. Could a painting with a highly diluted water-based glue tempera survive such an ordeal? Especially one painted on a piece of fabric? Could it last 700 years, 100 years, let alone 2,000 years? In the end, it appears that Dr. McCrone convinced no one but himself and the heirs to his company he founded that the image was or is a painting, in spite of the fact that he loudly and persistently held his observations in the face of empirical analysis, corroboration, and verification by a whole host of scientists in their varying fields of expertise. The fact that, in face of that, he could hold his view, even after the world's leading hematologists, nuclear scientists, particle physicists, chemists, biologists, space scientists, computer experts, photographic and fabric specialists, and a dozen of other scientific experts, including other microscopists, not even one of them agreed with him. Not even one. The official summary of Sturp findings is explicit. The conclusion they came after their 1978 study, the Shroud of Turin Project study in 1978, they came to this consensus among all of the scientists who studied the shrine. They said this, quote, after several years of exhaustive study and evaluation of the data, Sturt officially concludes no pigments, paints, dyes, or stains have been found on the fibrils. X-ray, fluorescence, and microchemistry on the fibrils preclude the possibility of paint being used as a method for creating the image. Ultraviolet and infrared evaluations confirm these studies. A scientific consensus is there are no chemical or physical methods known which can account for the totality of the image, nor can any combination of physical, chemical, biological, or medical circumstances explain the image adequately. Simple translation, there is no way that this image on the shroud came by naturalistic processes. Are you getting where I'm going with all this? The image was produced beyond the realm of the natural. Therefore, it transcends any scientific explanation for the origin, for how the shroud got on there. Remember, God's ways are higher than men's ways. The hard, inescapable fact is that the Sturt conclusion still stands to this day. And that is bolstered by the March 2013 second carbon-14 dating that places this ancient cloth well within the time frame Jesus lived, walked, and died, and rose in Eretz Israel, the land of Israel. And in spite of a number of challenges, no attempt to reproduce the image on the Shroud of Turin has yet been successful or even come close. But there is one certainty in all of this, beloved, and that is that the image exists. It is visible, resting on matter that can be touched, examined, tested, and analyzed, which it has been far more than any other anomalous artifact, or normal artifact, for that matter. That fact, that certainty, requires an answer from those who insist, like Dr. McCrone, that it simply could not be the burial shroud of the crucified and risen Jesus of Nazareth. If the Shroud of Turin is not a painting, and if modern scientists and artists cannot definitively and conclusively reproduce it, then I ask you, pray tell, what is it and why is it there? If you want my opinion, the statistic that it is the crucified Jesus mathematically far outweigh the chance that it is not. And if you accept that premise, then it must mean that God has given the world tangible, three-dimensional, and proof, indelible proof, I should add, that His Son whom He sent died for the sins of the world, and as an acceptance for that perfect payment for our sins, raised Him from the dead, and we have proof of it in the Shroud of Turin. Amen? First it was Stirp and then Strutt. Okay, it's been brought to my attention here that it is Strutt instead of Stirp. I've seen it both ways, so I'm assuming that the scientists develop both acronyms. So I guess either way.
Four references.
Yeah. Yeah, but I've seen it both ways, and then I corrected it earlier in the lecture when I saw it written the other way. Anyway, whether you want to say Strup or Stirp, it means the Shroud of Turin project that was conducted in 1978.